This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, May 2nd, 2014. I'm Caleb Brown. A robust civil society means that any government that wants to control it will run into problems. That's one of the reasons Peter Shook argues in his new book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. He spoke at the Cato Institute in March.
I'm delighted to be here at the Cato Institute to present a book that I fear may seem, from its title, like I'm bringing coals to Newcastle, why government fails so often. This is, after all, the Cato Institute. And so this message will be, I think, affirming to you. But what I hope to suggest is that you may not fully appreciate the reasons why government fails or the magnitude of the failure and how it might be those failures might be remedied. That is to say, most of the discussion about government failure is a highly theoretical, rhetorical, deeply politically philosophical level, rather than at an analytical level based on empirical evidence. And so that's, if I have a contribution to make to the people at Cato, that may be to enrich that particular kind of evidence for conclusions that you probably have no need for fortification about. I'm also delighted to be on a panel with Wally Olson, with whom I've worked for, my God, it's almost 30 years. He edited a book to which I contributed way back in the 1980s. And also to be on a panel with Arnold Kling, whose work I've respected for so long. So I begin with the notion of a crisis. And of course, every book is trying to sell the idea that there's a crisis. And this is particularly a crisis that, again, Cato followers are aware of and indeed have emphasized in your own lives. I have a lot of data on the decline in public confidence in the federal government. I will only mention a few points of special interest. Even among Democrats, there has been a rapid and precipitous decline in confidence. 41% had favorable views of the federal government in 2013. That's 41% of Democrats. That's down 10% in 1 year. And this was before Obamacare was launched. According to the Brookings Institution, 56% of Democrats believe that the federal government is mostly or completely broken. Democrats. I mentioned that these statistics were gathered before the Obamacare fiasco in its rollout. Tom Edsel, in an op-ed in the Times yesterday, suggests that the consequences of that rollout are far greater than is anticipated by most political observers. He thinks it's going to ramify throughout the next several elections. What is the biggest threat to America's future, according to the public? 64% say it's big government, while only 26% said big business. And this polling was conducted only a few years after the recession. So that's it seems to me a very telling a point of departure. In 2011, 79% of those polled were frustrated or angry with the federal government. 74% said the same thing in 2007 before the recession. Now, what are the reasons for this decline in public confidence in the government? I propose several explanations, but the one that I'm going to concentrate on and the one that constitutes the bulk of my analysis is sort of a straightforward one. The government performs very, very poorly. When I say the government, by the way, I'm referring to the federal government, not other governments, and I'm referring to domestic policy, not national security, military, or foreign affairs policy. My book is limited in those respects. So that's my subject, why government fails. There are a variety of theories as to why the government performs so poorly. An emphasis that will not surprise those of you who live in Washington is the explanation of partisan bickering and congressional paralysis. The Democrats blame the Republicans blame the Democrats for any failures that they're prepared to concede. I emphatically disagree with this. If you examine our history of political discourse, it has been tendentious, uncivil, angry, and furiously partisan from the very, very beginning. Some of the greatest achievements of the past, the Intercontinental Railroad and Hoover Dam and interstate highway system, were accomplished only fitfully and after a protracted disagreement by policymakers. Polarization, I argue, is not the cause of our problems. It's the consequence of our problems. And there's a remarkable correlation that I think confirms this point of view. First is that the growth in government spending and policy ambitions has paralleled almost perfectly, if you chart them, the growth in public disaffection and contempt for government. Per capita spending by the federal government today is greater than in France, Germany, and the UK. This growth occurs in good times and bad. It's unlinked. It's been set adrift from the Keynesian cyclical uses of government. And it doesn't depend on whether Republicans or Democrats control what goes on in Washington. The debt to GDP ratio of the federal government exceeds that in most EU countries. And it also exceeds the Latin American average, just to provide some context. This growth of federal government is obscured by a number of factors, except to those who study these matters very carefully. One is the immense growth in private contracting by the government, the immense participation in the implementation of government programs by nonprofits and state and local governments. And the myth that the United States has a small public sector and is a welfare state laggard, although perhaps true in some comparative terms, is, as a myth, utterly false. One way of understanding what's happened is summarized by, and I summarize in the book, by James Q. Wilson, the late James Q. Wilson, and John Dulio, who distinguished between the old system and the new system. The old system, they write, had a small agenda. When someone proposed adding a new issue to the public agenda, a major debate often arose over whether it was legitimate for the federal government to take action at all in the matter. For the government to take bold action under the system, the nation usually had to be facing a crisis. Each succeeding crisis left the government bureaucracy somewhat larger than it had been before, but when the crisis ended, the exercise of extraordinary powers ended. The new system is characterized by a large policy agenda, the end of the debate over the legitimacy of government action, except in the area of First Amendment freedoms, the diffusion and decentralization of power in Congress, and the multiplication of interest groups. Under the old system, the checks and balances made it difficult for the government to start a new program, and so the government remained relatively small. Under the new system, these checks and balances make it hard to change what the government is already doing, and so the government remains large. So my central theme, the core idea of my book, is that federal domestic policy failures are caused by deep, recurrent, structural, systemic, endemic conditions. It doesn't matter which party is in power. It doesn't matter what the state of the economy is. I think that as a result of this, and as a result of my analysis of the reasons for this, liberals, conservatives, and I dare say, libertarians have an enormous stake in understanding these reasons. Well, how do I analyze the reasons? First, let me say just a bit about my methodology. I rely on social science assessments by economists, political scientists, think tanks, GAO, CBO, inspector generals of federal departments. My criterion for success or failure is cost effectiveness. And I devote an entire chapter to explaining what I mean by cost effectiveness, what methodologies exist, particularly cost benefit analysis to measure effectiveness. I believe it is a very balanced and subtle assessment of cost benefit analysis, which is itself an assessment methodology, and the principles for its use in light of its shortcomings. But that's what I'm talking about when I discuss success. We could measure success in other ways. I don't think any of them would be very satisfactory. Certainly political success is hardly a justified use of that term, nor does the continuation of programs over long periods of time in multiple administrations a valid measure of success or failure. So what are these structural reasons for failure that I have been presaging in these introductory remarks? Well, the first is political culture. The political culture in the United States imposes enormous constraints on the effectiveness of government policy, whatever that government policy will be, although certain government policies are hobbled more by these political constraints than others. And let me emphasize at the outset that many aspects of the political culture are highly desirable and ought not to be changed. But even if they should be changed, they can't be changed very easily. Indeed, I think it's virtually impossible to change these features of our political culture, precisely because they are cultural. They're deeply embedded in our in the way in which we view the world around us. So, what are these elements that I emphasize? The first is constitutionalism. That's the most familiar to you, and one that the Cato Institute emphasizes in its own work. I needn't rehearse that. A second is decentralization, which makes it very difficult for federal policy to be implemented, or indeed for the federal government to know how its policies will impact those who are its intended beneficiaries. A third is the protection of individual rights, a sacred mission in our culture, and one that makes it very difficult for government to do whatever it wants to do effectively because of the strong protections given to individual freedoms. A fourth constraint is interest group pluralism, which is perhaps more robust in the United States than anywhere else. It's one of the glories of our system, but it's also a feature of our system that renders government either impotent or feckless and blundering. Another is the acceptance of social and economic inequality by the vast majority of the population. Now, this may strike you as somewhat odd, but when one compares the United States with all other liberal democracies, we tend to care less about equality than we do, except for equality of opportunity, qualification. We care less about equality of results than any other societies. We worry less about it for deeply embedded reasons. So that policies that are designed to promote equality of outcomes meet a kind of resistance that they would not meet in other countries, particularly where those efforts by government create enormous inefficiencies along the way, as they almost invariably do. Another feature of the political environment is our moralism. Moralism derived from both our religious convictions and the strongly religious basis of our social values, and the nature of our politics, which lends itself to political moralizing, partly because it's mimicking the religious convictions of the American people, and partly for other reasons. Another important political constraint is social diversity, and what that implies is that a uniform federal law cannot be nimble enough and flexible enough and variegated enough to reflect the underlying needs and desires of the population. Again, we are unique in our social diversity in any modern liberal democracy for a variety of reasons, not simply for reasons of immigration, but also because of our religious diversity and our economic system. Another important constraint on the effectiveness of policymaking is populist suspicion of technical expertise and official discretion. Public opinion, very powerful in the United States, more powerful, I dare say, than in other liberal democracies, which is one of the reasons I think why, for example, one of many examples, capital punishment is sustained in most American states, even today, whereas the elites tend to disfavor capital punishment. In Europe, the elites get their way, and the United States, the people, broadly speaking, get their way on issues of that kind. And then finally, civil society, with its part of the diversity of which I spoke earlier, but our civil society is so robust and so varied and so energetic that a government that seeks to domesticate it or to regulate it, or even in some cases to work with it, is going to run into problems of ineffectiveness. So that's the first important feature that's structural, that's endemic, and that hobbles federal policymaking. A second one has to do with incentives. And in this chapter, I discuss public choice theory and its shortcomings as a way of introducing the problem of incentives. And I develop a number of different propositions based on my reading of this literature. So I'll just read them, the headlines in this distillation of principles. Ordinary citizens have little or no rational incentive to participate actively in political activity. Political actors design policymaking institutions and processes to advance their self-interest. The political effectiveness of a group depends, among other things, on its ability to manage incentives so as to overcome structural obstacles to collective action. Officials have powerful incentives to provide voters and interest groups with short-term benefits and to hide the long-term costs that must pay for those benefits. The political dynamics of public policy depend on how it distributes its benefits and costs among voters and groups. Much political activity consists of narrow interest log rolling at the expense of taxpayers, something that Arnold Kling has written a great deal about. Moral hazard is a major source of incentive-based programmatic failure and propositions of that kind. And the examples that I provide and explicate include many, many different kinds of programs, the Social Security Disability Insurance, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, Fannie and Freddie, and a host of others. The next systemic defect, if you will, although these are not all defects, I should, as I said before, our society is rich and successful as a society, as distinguished from polity, by reason of many of these factors. But the next one is what I call collective irrationality. And here I emphasize voters' ignorance about public issues. a literature that many of you have encountered in one way or another, perhaps through Daniel Kahneman's recent book, but the basic research was conducted by Kahneman and Tversky, and it's now become discussed, not only in the academy, but even in the halls of Congress. And Cass Sunstein, whose work many of you know, also relies heavily on this literature. A third literature is one that's been developed by my colleague at Yale, Dan Kahan, which he calls cultural cognition. What he means by that is that on a large number of public issues, when he tests for people's views on these issues, he finds that those views are almost entirely insensitive to new information, that people come to these issues with preconceived cultural stereotypes and ideologies, and they're very, very difficult to move. And you could pretty much predict, by knowing what those ideologies are, what their position is on climate change or abortion or any number of other issues, where evidence might alter the opinion of a rational individual. Another and extremely important systemic problem is poor information. This is, I hope, no surprise to you. I hope you were all marinated in the work of Friedrich von Hayek, who emphasized the nature of the information problem better than anybody else before or since. But some of the policy manifestations of that are the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives information about gun use, their information is very outmoded, it's very limited, and so forth, not because these officials are stupid or ill-informed, but because Congress has made it extremely difficult for them to collect this data and maintain this data, much less analyze and employ it. The Volcker Rule, which I discuss at some length, not that I've read it, but neither has anybody else, is another example of how poorly informed those who write our laws and regulations are about the intricacies of the way in which markets and other aspects, other areas of our society operate. So 2 weeks after the Volcker Rule was issued, you may not have read this, it was not widely covered by the press, except for the Wall Street Journal, I think, is that banking authority, regulatory authorities were obliged or felt obliged to cut back on the Volcker Rule insofar as it applied to local banks. Why? Because it affected local banks in a way that the rulemakers had not anticipated, and these effects were dire, dire indeed. Just one example. Another feature of our policymaking system is its rigidity, where adaptability and flexibility are needed. Here I provide a number of examples. Again, the Postal Service has not adapted well to the new technological and market facts. Not because they're stupid or indifferent to these changes. They actually have tried hard to convince Congress to allow them to compete with FedEx and other services, but Congress has made it almost impossible for them to do that, in some cases prohibiting what would clearly be the rational response to that. Another example, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Supreme Court was wrong, I believe, in its decision last year to strike down the Section 4 formula defining the jurisdictions that were covered, but it was absolutely right in its denunciation of the anachronistic nature of that formula in 2013, which is when the decision was rendered, as distinguished from 1965 when it was enacted. A sixth element is the lack of credibility needed to secure the cooperation of other actors. This is extremely important and quite interesting, in part because, and also dismaying, because there's no good solution to this problem. The problem is this, that if you are going to induce other actors, be they state and local governments or private actors, to act in the way you want them to act in order for a policy to succeed, you have to assure them that the rules of the game aren't going to change, that they can invest safely in nature and the details of the program. But government can't do that. Why can't it do that? Well, for a perfectly good reason. Government is supposed to be accountable to voters and to their changing preferences. So it can't keep its promises, if you will. And there are very few, if any, techniques that will enable the government to bond itself and lash itself to the mast with respect to policies in ways that would secure the confident participation of those whose resources it needs to succeed. Perfect example of this, Obamacare vastly expanded Medicaid, and in order to induce states to expand their Medicaid programs in the desired fashion, it offered to pay 100% of the cost of expanded Medicaid for 3 years, and after that, it would pay, I think it's 85%. Well, many states simply didn't believe it. They thought it was like being given a gift of a baby elephant. That's fine when you receive the elephant, but then the elephant grows and grows and grows, and you have to feed him and house him. So lots of states are not adopting these otherwise quite the plausible and perhaps even desirable changes. Then there's the problem of mismanagement, which is endemic, which is structural. And I have a lengthy discussion of fraud, waste, and abuse in the government. I don't need to rehearse that there, except to say that much of the fraud, waste, and abuse are the result of structural factors embedded in the way in which government makes its decisions, including the complexity of programs and including the very poor design of reimbursement techniques. But I won't dwell on that. A major theme of my book is that markets are a fundamental impediment to effective public policy. And many of you will say, and I will agree in most cases, that that's a good thing. But consider the features of markets that dog government efforts to tame them or to live with them. The speed of markets compared with the incredible slowness and inflexibility of government. The diversity of markets. Again, government regulates in a rather uniform, binary fashion. You're either in or you're out, guilty or you're innocent. You're in this category, you're not in that category. Whereas the markets cater to diversity. They even induce additional diversity where they can think they can find a niche that is profitable. The information demands that markets place on regulators are very, very high. It demands that cannot be met by regulators. The price and substitution effects of markets means that when government adopts a policy, it will usually raise the price. Sometimes it will attempt to lower the price, but it often, particularly in its regulatory policies, raises the price of a particular service or activity. And of course, the market responds by trying to find other ways to meet that demand at a lower cost or at a higher quality. And that may, as in many examples that I discuss in the chapter, undermine, if not utterly defeat, the government's policy. There are trans-jurisdictional effects of markets. Markets do not respect jurisdictional lines. Not only is this a problem in terms of international competition, as with the Basel rules, banking and international finance, but the creation of informal or black markets as a result of the ability of markets to evade the kinds of lines that government draws. Political influence, of course, is exercised by market participants through campaign contributions, the influence wielded by large companies and other mechanisms. That tends to subvert the effectiveness or the coherence of government policies, even where those policies might otherwise be coherent and effective. I have a considerable discussion of political influence by markets on government, and I think it's much more complicated than is usually understood. Markets do indeed exercise a great deal of political influence. On the other hand, most of the influence that they exercise is not particularly partisan. And secondly, it represents the actual real-world individual effects of government policy on the part of its consumers, its employees, its investors, and so forth. So those are real factors that ought to be represented robustly in our political process. Then there are enforcement obstacles that markets pose to government. There are lots of reasons for that, which I discuss. And again, some of them are deeply rooted and unlikely to be changeable. Rational expectations, a concept that economists have developed to explain why the market tends to anticipate policy changes and to incorporate, to respond to those policy changes before the policies take effect and thereby neutralize the intended effect of those policies in many cases. Two other effects of markets. One is that there are no good substitutes for market ordering. The two major ones alternatives to market ordering are law, government policy on the one hand, and social norms on the other. And they certainly have their roles to play, but they're no match for markets in most areas of public policy. And the final effect of markets is moral hazard, which is immense. And we've seen some of the consequences of that moral hazard in recent years, particularly in connection with the Great Recession. But there are countless programs that exhibit this moral hazard. That is the tendency of people to act in ways that will advance their interests when the government, through its policy, makes that activity or that service less costly than it would otherwise be. Crop insurance, flood insurance, lots of examples of moral hazard. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, a very good and sobering examples of that. The next fundamental structural problem that I devote a very long chapter to is the obstacles to implementation. These obstacles are important. They're not readily dispensed with. They're not readily circumvented. And government attempts to overcome these obstacles in a variety of different ways. And I divided this chapter into the following categories, but just to give you a flavor of what I mean. Attempting to perfect markets, to supplement markets, for example, through infrastructure. And I have a discussion of Amtrak, for example, which I came down today, and the economic disaster that it has been. Suppressing markets, simplifying markets, subsidizing markets. I have a long discussion under this rubric of student financial aid programs, a disaster about to happen, if it's not already upon us. The ethanol program, many, many other examples. Redirecting markets, as in the effort under the Community Reinvestment Act to force banks to invest in areas that they would not rather invest in, on the theory that their failure to invest in those areas must be due to racism. Reintroducing markets, modifying markets, and recruiting markets. By recruiting markets, I mean those efforts largely in the environmental area to use market mechanisms to render regulation more effective. That's been very, very limited. There have been some successes with that. Efforts to expand that have been largely unsuccessful, but that's an area in which I think markets and public policy might be more compatible. Then I have a chapter on the limits of law, the inherent limits of law. That is to say, the limits of law that assert themselves whenever one uses law as an instrument of public policy, which is virtually all the time. That's the form that policy takes. And I discuss its ubiquity, the trade-off between its simplicity and its complexity, ambiguity, discretion. These are all endemic features of legal regulation. The procedural apparatus that goes along with it, the inertia that it creates, and then the crowding out of spontaneous low-cost cooperation by markets. And then I have a chapter on bureaucracy in which I emphasize the problems created by congressional influence, the extraordinary penetration of bureaucracy by Congress, often for good reasons, but with predictable, baleful effects on policy coherence. The legalism that bureaucracies tend to cultivate, leadership problems, layering problems, and here I just want to read. How am I doing on time?
You're a little past.
I'm a little past time. Okay, well, this is sort of amusing, so if I may, I'll just... I write, "Dear reader, I'll bet that you did not know that there are now many federal officials who are denominated deputy, deputy assistant secretary, associate deputy assistant secretary, deputy associate deputy administrator, chief of staff to the associate deputy assistant secretary, and that this thickening, this layering has occurred in almost every department." I also discuss compensation status, performance, and morale problems in the bureaucracy. Again, these are endemic. They're not contingent on who is running the bureaucracy. The difficulties of imposing discipline, the failure of the senior executive service, difficulty of securing low-level compliance, contracting out by the bureaucracy, and its poor management of contracts, and the isolation of the bureaucracy from the realities that surround it. Then I have a chapter on the policy successes, and I won't, because I'm out of time, I won't rehearse those. I've just written an op-ed, which I hope that New York Times is going to publish, which tries to identify what I view as policy successes in according to the criterion that I have advanced. And it tries to draw lessons from those examples as to why successful policies succeed, whereas the vast majority of policies do not. And we can discuss that in the Q&A if you're interested in that. And finally, I have a chapter on remedies. These remedies are incremental because I'm an incrementalist for all the reasons why everybody should be an incrementalist. In that the world is simply too complex for us, especially our political world, too complex for us to be able to predict with any confidence at all what the effects of a particular change will be. And these remedies are also cross-cutting. That is to say, I've decided not to propose fixes for particular programs, but rather to identify remedies that might cut across all government programs. And I've organized them according to each of the structural conditions that I've just laid out for you. So I'm out of time, and I appreciate your forbearance, and I look forward to Dr. Kling's comments and your questions, comments. Thank you.
Peter Schuch is author of Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. You can watch a full forum for the book at cato.org.